Log Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
I'm Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters Podcast, coming to you live from my studio in the great city of Corryton, Tennessee, which is pretty much just a blip on the map unless you're looking for us, but it's a great little place I like to call home. And in a quiet little peaceful place like this, you don't really hear much about the topic that we're discussing today, but it certainly is an important one, and that is the problem of evil. So today we are going to get philosophical, and we have an excellent guest to help us with that. My guest today is Dr. David Wood. Dr. Wood, are you here with us?
Yeah, I'm here. What's up?
Hey there. And you just recently got your doctorate, didn't you?
Yeah, just not too long ago.
Yeah, congratulations on that. So today we are going to be discussing the subject of your doctorate, the problem of evil, but I would think it'd be helpful if my audience got the background story on you, like how you came to Christ and why the problem of evil is so relevant to you.
Okay, what do you want to know?
Well, just tell us your story.
It's kind of long, so you can jump in and steer it whenever you want. But yeah, I grew up as an atheist, and I don't remember ever believing in God when I was growing up, but I had some problems. I was what you'd call a sociopath, meaning I didn't form normal emotional attachments to people. I didn't know this when I was growing up. I didn't know this until I saw it on on some paperwork from a psychiatric hospital a long time later. But when I was growing up, all I knew was I thought people were weird when they would cry over, you know, their dog dying or a friend dying or family dying or something like that. I thought there was something wrong with them, like they were being irrational. And you know, that kind of makes sense, right? I mean, what are you crying for? It's not helping anything. It's not changing anything. You can't do anything about it. Why are you getting upset? Did you think this person or animal or whatever is going to live forever? No, you knew it was going to happen, and you can't change anything, so get over it. And so that would be my reaction when something would happen. But I was familiar with was myself, so I thought I was the normal one, and everyone else had some issues. And I always thought I was the normal one until one day I was in high school, and my best friend Jimmy Lindholm died parasailing. The whole time we were growing up, he always said he wanted to go parasailing. The kind where you not the kind at the beach, but the kind where you jump off a cliff with a parachute. So he wanted to do that. He jumped off, his harness broke, and he died. And I just went over to his house one day, knocked on the door, and some people there told me that he had died, and I remember walking away, thinking, "Wow, I just don't care." In other words, up until that point, it always struck me as normal and rational to not be bothered. But here, I was thinking, "Well, this is my best friend. I should have some kind of reaction to this," and I didn't. So I started thinking, "There's something. What's going on here?" And the end result of searching for what was different about me was I concluded that I had evolved to a higher state of humanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
So everyone else is held back by their emotions, and eventually you get to a level of pure reason and logic, not held back by emotion and all that and attachments and so on. And of course, I'm just a sociopath. That's it. There's a simple explanation. I just had no clue about anything psychological. So I didn't know anything about any of that, and I just concluded that I'm different from other people because, people turn out differently, and sometimes we get new abilities. So I was interpreting this as some kind of new ability that others lack, when it's actually, as I would realize later, it's a defect. It's a defect not to have normal emotional responses to things. But I didn't know that, and I eventually went to a couple of psychiatric hospitals over various things, went to jail, went to a couple of prisons, and I was in a jail when I met this Christian named Randy, and I walked up to him. He was reading reading the Bible on his bunk, and I walked up to him and I told him that the only reason he was a Christian is because he'd been born in the United States, and that if he'd been born somewhere else, he'd believe something else, because people like him just believe what they're taught to believe. And I of course thought this was an original thought, but I've heard lots of atheists say the same thing since then, that Christians just believe what they're taught because they're born here, and other places they'd be born in other places. And it never occurred to me that I was taught that life formed out in the ocean on its own, and that the universe came out of nowhere on its own. In other words, I believed everything I was taught to believe, but I thought it was, people aren't exactly very consistent, and I wasn't. So I wasn't applying the same reasoning to myself. I'm pointing to the Christians. Christians believe what they're taught, but me, I'm a free thinker. But something weird happened when I was talking to this Randy guy. He actually started putting up a fight, which had never happened before. Every time I talked to Christians, they would back down as soon as I started arguing with them over anything. And it was, hey, we're not here to have a fight. We're not here to argue. Let's all just get along, blah, 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 blah. And I always took this as just total cowardice. The reason you're backing down is you don't know what you're talking about, and it's stupid. And since it's stupid, you can't defend it, and that's why you won't stand up for it. And Randy wasn't like that. He would object to everything I was saying and respond to it. And this guy just tore me to pieces, which I thought was weird because I'm the most evolved person in the entire universe. And here I'm getting beat by the last person I should ever be getting beat by is a Christian. And so I'm sitting there talking to Randy, and we became friends, although I was trying to beat him. And we got into one of the world's only fasting battles, I guess, Randy would fast for a certain amount of time. He would go 7 days on nothing but water, and I would outdo him. He's just doing it. When I asked him, he said he was only fasting then because, in jail he has that opportunity. He has an opportunity to fast for long periods of time, like he's in a monastery. and so he wanted to do that. Me, I just wanted to beat the Christian because he was beating me when we were arguing, and so I had to beat him at other things. And so we would go back and forth. He went 7 days, I went 10, and I had never fasted. I don't think I'd ever fasted a meal in my life, and I went 10 days straight on nothing but trying to beat this Christian. And so we kept going back and forth, and eventually he went 40 days. He went 32 days on nothing but water, and then he started drinking like juice for the rest of that. And he told me why. He told me that Jesus had done it. So I said, all right, I'm going 42. So I was going to beat him and Jesus, and I was on, I think, day 11 when police thought I was trying to kill myself. They knew I had a psychiatric history, so they put me on suicide watch. They put me in this little cell. No, before I was in a dorm with probably, I don't know, 30 other guys. But they put me in the cell, and it's back in the cell when I picked up the pace on studying Christianity. I'd been reading a little bit before then, but I hatched a plan when I was back there that I was going to study and find all the problems and errors and contradictions in the Bible and go back and beat this Randy guy. And it was in the course of that I realized that, you know, and like many other Christian apologists today would say, and like the Apostle Paul said, I realize that Christianity stands or falls with the resurrection. So if you want to attack Christianity, just go after the resurrection. So I was looking into the resurrection and so on. It started bothering me how the apostles died, because I tried to think of other people in history who died for something that they knew was a lie, and I couldn't think of one person in all of history who died for something that he knew he made up. Lots of people die for things that are false, but you have to believe them. And up until then, I had believed that the apostles, you know, Jesus died, and they were upset by that, but they wanted to carry on his message and his work, and so they said he rose from the dead, and they started their religion that way. So I believe that they had made it up. They had made up the story about him rising from the dead. So the fact that these guys were going to their just brutal, bloody deaths, proclaiming something that they had made up, that started to bother me, because that's the sort of you don't die for that sort of thing. That's the sort of thing where, you know, when the sword goes to your throat or they start getting ready to crucify you, you say, okay, I recant my story. But they didn't, and so I was thinking, what are the odds? What are the odds that I can't think of another person in all of history who dies for something he knew he made up? What are the odds that all of the people in history who died for something they knew they made up, if they all just happened to be this one guy's apostle? And so I started thinking, well, you know, maybe it's a better explanation that the reason they were going to their horrible bloody death is that they had seen him alive again after he was dead. And so started thinking about that, didn't become entirely convinced, but it got me to the point where, you know, I'm sitting here, I base my entire life on, you know, on there not being consequences for what I'm doing, and I can do whatever I want and this and that, and if I'm wrong, then wow, that matters a lot. So if there is, you know, if something else is true, then I need to pay attention to that. And so thinking about that sort of thing a lot, and basically I got to the point where I'm in a cell, I'm getting ready to be sent to my third psychiatric hospital, and I start thinking, what have I got to lose if I sit down and pray here? If I pray and this turns out to be false, it's not like I'm getting any worse. I'm already all messed up and sitting in a jail cell. It's not like I'm going to get any worse. I'm already pretty horrible. So I bowed down and prayed. And when I sat up from that prayer, like the entire world looked different. Like I was like everything was a different color or something. But it was a pretty instant change. And I sat up and realized, I don't want to hurt anyone anymore. I don't want to do anything bad right now. So anyway, spent a lot of time studying the Bible and every book I could get my hand on. Started studying apologetics while I was in there still. And got out and went back to school, went to college, met Nabil Qureshi there, met my wife there, finished in apologetics and the problem of evil, just because that's kind of where the battle's at.
Mm-hmm. And we have had Nabil Qureshi on our show before. He was a guest back on May 1st talking about Islam. And I know that just now Mike Lacona put on his Facebook page that this interview is going on. And he happens to be a good friend of yours. I think you were part of the Dream Team with him at one time, weren't you?
Yeah, way back in the day.
And if I'm remembering...
That's probably before you were born. No, I'm just kidding.
No, it wasn't. I know it was because I remember a great story about that my wife's told me constantly about some neighboring kids giving her a hard time and how you had said, "Want me to go out there and walk the dog with you?"
Yeah, and then I came up with a better plan. My four brothers were in town. I was going to have them walk down the street. Those kids will fight anybody.
Yeah, and well, you all can't see that David is a big guy. Okay, he could take care of anyone. And with your work on The Problem of Evil, you've even debated John Loftus on this topic.
Yeah, we did a debate on The Problem of Evil. We did another, that was at Old Dominion University, and we did another debate that was a radio debate, and we had we did another debate on the existence of God.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we're talking about The Problem of Evil, something I do like about the approach that you come from is that for many of us, the problem of evil is really emotionally gripping for us, and you don't have that problem.
No, I don't. And you know, if someone doesn't know what it's like to be a sociopath, when you see, you know, when you see starving kids or murders or something like that, it doesn't bother me. I don't feel bad about it. I can know that it's wrong, right? I can sit there and look at something and I say, I know that's wrong, or I know that it's unjust for that person to suffer, but I don't get a bad feeling about it. So there's that. But I mean, it's interesting because I used to argue with Christians and theists, and I never appealed to the argument from evil at all, even once. I would argue other things. If God wants us to believe in Him, why doesn't He appear to us? I would say things like that, or I would explain the origins of Christianity and things like that. But I would never appeal to evil because I always knew it. Well, it was always a thought in my mind, at least, that if God does exist, we're pretty bad by comparison. And I don't. Why would God ever give us this sort of hedonistic paradise that we all think we deserve? When we're pretty bad by comparison, so why would he? Why would he always make sure we don't get hurt? Why would he do that? So the problem of evil when I was an atheist was not persuasive.
Yeah, although I should point out that this doesn't mean you're unable to help those you are struggling with the problem of evil. In fact, there have been a number of times my wife and I have called you about a situation, and I think your difference really makes it very helpful, because you can just give us a straighten up on how it is. You're saying, well, here's what Plato says, here's what Aristotle says, here's what Scripture says, and leave it at that.
Yeah, well, what's interesting, I mean, when you're talking about the problem of evil, you can mean a couple things by that. You can mean, you know, this sort of what it's like, you know, having to believe in, you know, believing in God when we're confronted with all this suffering, how we can cope with suffering when things get bad. That's sort of one aspect, and there I wouldn't exactly be much help. But most of the time when we're talking about the problem of evil, it's the philosophical problem of evil that. It can be put in a lot of different ways, but you know, for instance, it can be put that if God exists and God is perfect in power, He's perfect in knowledge, and He's perfect in goodness, then if that sort of being exists, if the being that Christians claim exists actually exists, there would be no evil, because a perfectly good being would want there to be nothing but good, and a perfectly powerful being would be able to do whatever he wants to do, and so there wouldn't be any evil, because he would be powerful enough to make sure that there's nothing but good. And so that has nothing to do with any particulars or any feelings. It doesn't have anything to do with how you feel about good and evil in the world. It's strictly philosophical. There's that particular version that I just put would claim that there's an actual contradiction in the theist beliefs. You Christians believe that this being exists, and you believe that evil exists, and those two statements, the statement God exists and the statement evil exists, can't both be true. And so, but there, it's that's just straightforward philosophical examination of whether that argument stands or falls. And so. If we're talking about the problem of evil in the philosophical sense, straight up investigation.
Okay, well, that's a perfect segue now for us to take a quick break. I'm Nick Peters with Deeper Waters Podcast. My guest is Dr. David Wood, and we'll be back after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
And we're here with David. We're talking about the problem of evil. Now, I know when you were an atheist, Dr. Wood, you didn't use the problem of evil as an argument, but you've read many atheist works since then, and like we said, you debated John Loftus, and this usually is one of the most common arguments that's brought up against theism, isn't it?
Oh, no question. And just to clarify, I will say that this is by far the strongest argument that atheists have. So, in other words, saying that it wasn't persuasive to me isn't saying that it's not the best argument. It's not even saying that it's not a good argument. It's saying I didn't find this argument persuasive for various reasons. And that's one thing that sort of everyone needs to get their minds around, whether Christian or non-Christian or atheist or whatever, is that, one person finding an argument persuasive or unpersuasive doesn't mean that it's a good argument or a bad argument. And I wasn't impressed by this argument when I was an atheist, but I was sort of blocked by some issues I had from, really being able to sympathize with a lot of the evil in the world. This is definitely the most talked about philosophical problem for theism. It's definitely the strongest argument that atheists have.
Yeah, I'd say that probably one of the most for powerful reasons why this is so gripping is that most of us do experience it on an existential level, that we do undergo some sort of suffering in this life. And even when we look up, even in the Bible, we'll find in the Psalms, the Book of Job, question of God, why? And that question is still with us today.
Yeah, and it's actually with us in a different way than it was in the ancient world. In the ancient world, we can look back to the ancient world or the medieval period and so on, in one sense things were much worse for them because they had a much people would die younger. You had a much higher chance of your children dying while they're young. Various sicknesses, you had the plagues and so on. It was a much rougher world to live in, and so they had more direct experience with evil than we do. But we're in a different situation of we know about a lot more evil because of we're in the information age, and so back in the day, 500 years ago, someone dies. If there's an earthquake in China, we don't hear it. People in Europe don't hear anything about it. Whereas now we're constantly bombarded with information on a daily basis about horrible things happening all over the world, about school shootings and earthquakes, famines, everything. We hear about it all the time. So even though we have sort of comparatively more comfortable lives than people before us, or even people in certain parts of the world, we have comparatively more comfortable lives, we are familiar with much more evil as far as information is concerned, even though we don't have as much direct experience of it.
And we could also add in what you were saying, you mentioned, in fact, two different kinds of evil. You mentioned school shootings, and then you mentioned things like earthquakes and famine, and both of those fall into a different category, don't they?
Yeah, well, the school shooting, that would be that would be classified as moral evil, and just some people are bothered by the term evil when it's applied to natural things, but when philosophers are using the term, evil is just anything that's bad. So it doesn't mean evil that has some sort of moral connotation to it. When we're talking about an evil person, that's what philosophers would consider the moral evil, doing bad things, wanting to harm other people, and you can act on the moral evil. So you can actually go out and shoot up a school, or just was it yesterday, there was a, you know, shooting at LAX airport. You can actually act on it, or but you might not act on it. So you could sit around, you know, wanting to do things or trying to do things, not actually doing them. But if you have the evil intention, that's still the moral evil. So on the one hand, you have that kind of evil, and on the other hand, again, evil just in this context just means something bad. So it can be morally bad. A morally bad person is other things held equal, worse than a morally good person. But you also have natural evil. Here it's not that there is some agent involved in making things bad. It's just bad things happen in the world. Natural disasters, diseases, birth defects. These are examples of evil or something bad happening, suffering happening as a result of just something happening in the natural world not being perfect, or as the atheists would say, it's not being what we would expect, given that it was created by a perfectly good creator.
Okay, well, let's start then. When you have a problem of evil, I mean, you said that evil is things that are bad and such. That to me, though, sounds kind of like synonymous. It's like saying evil is evil. What would be the full definition of evil that the philosophers would give?
Well, there wouldn't be any one definition. I pointed out that it's bad because some people they're only familiar with using the term evil in its moral context. You wouldn't look at a tornado and say, oh, that evil tornado. But you would say, oh, that evil child molester or something like that. So some people just aren't familiar with using it like that. Whereas you know, among philosophers and theologians, there's no problem. It's evil is taken in sort of a wider context. So I would just use the term bad, just because people do say, oh, look at that tornado is really bad for us. It's really it's doing something bad. And that's just to you know, shift into the broader meaning of evil. But as far as evil is concerned, there's not a it's kind of rough when you're talking about a direct definition. You of course would be familiar with you know, some of the early Christian thinkers like Augustine and Aquinas and so on, that evil is a privation of good. And if you don't really understand what's being said, what's being claimed by that, by saying that evil is a privation, you can say, no, that's not an accurate definition of what evil is, because it sounds like you're saying that it doesn't exist, that evil doesn't really exist. Of course evil exists, at least in one sense, and that there really are bad things. There really are very evil people out there. And, you know, hurricanes and the damage they do, it is actually really bad. But that's not what's being claimed when you say that evil is a privation. What we mean is it's similar to the claim that darkness is an absence of light, or that cold is an absence of heat. And in that, you know, cold is real in the sense that it you know what cold is, and darkness is real. But what we mean is that these things do not have their being in something positive, in some positive state of being. Cold is just it's the absence of something. It's still real in that it is that absence. And similarly, evil is where there should be something. There should be something good there. When a person is evil, it's a privation of good. He should be some other way, and we recognize that this good person should be different. I mean, a bad person should be different. He should be the opposite he should have the opposite of these evil tendencies. And when there's there's natural evil, these things in the world could have been in a different sort of relation where they didn't end up destroying each other and hurting a lot of people. It could have had a much better relation, and it didn't. And so this could sort of capture the senses of natural and moral evil.
Yep. One picture I like to use is that, for instance, if I looked at the shirt I'm wearing right now and said, oh, there's a hole in it. There must be a moth in my closet. where that's a privation. But if I said, well, my aunt lives across the street, she can sew, she can go fill it up, where that deals with a problem. But if I said, if I just prep a whole shirt bin, then there's nothing left. If you remove the hole, you fix the problem. If you remove everything else, there's really nothing to deal with.
Yeah.
And in fact, what this would mean for some people is that people like Peter Kraft and William and Craig have in fact said that evil in its own way, if we admit its reality, can be evidence for the existence of God.
Yeah, yeah, that is one of the it's what would be classified as a presuppositionalist response, in that when a skeptic is saying such and such is evil, he would be appealing to some kind of moral law, right? You can do this in two senses. One, you're saying that certain things are actually evil, independent, objectively evil, right? It's not. Oh, I dislike this. If you're just saying I dislike this, well then, I don't like tomatoes, right? So you wouldn't say that tomatoes are evil. You have to be saying that that some things, regardless of my opinion about them, are actually evil. Well, if it's independent of how I feel about them, or how any human being feels about them, then there has to be some sort of higher standard than us. There must be some standard of right and wrong, good and bad, that is beyond us. And if that's the case, then from a position of a naturalist, there is nothing like that. So as a naturalist, how can you be saying that there are evil things when that requires, even in maintaining it, that there is something beyond human beings that is the standard of good and bad, right and wrong? So there are kind of two ways that a skeptic or an atheist or a naturalist who's saying that there's a conflict between God and evil, and in that context, admitting that there is evil. There's two ways. One is that in maintaining that there is evil, he is maintaining that there is some standard independent of us that is the standard of right and wrong. But also, he's admitting that we have access to that. And the question is, why would we have access to that sort of thing, right? Animals in general, they don't have access to them. On a naturalistic perspective, we got our present abilities. Human beings developed our abilities just because our ancestors happened to survive and reproduce more than others. And how do you ever get to the point where we survive enough, we reproduce enough, and suddenly we get to the point where we have access to laws that we can't see, right? You don't see the claim that murder is wrong or something like that. You don't see it. You don't find it with a microscope. You don't find it with a telescope. You don't get this through your senses, but you have some kind of access to it. And from a naturalistic perspective, that makes no sense. It can make you can, and just to clarify, you can make sense as a naturalist of the claim that murder is wrong. But what you mean by that claim is something very different from what a Christian would mean by that claim. As if you're really a naturalist, you'd have to say that, various ancestors that we had, they worked better and survived better if they had a kind of herd instinct, and this helped them to outcompete other organisms, and this is why they developed that instinct, and, could also be influenced by society when we realize we can work better together in society if we adhere to certain rules. But basically, as a naturalist or as an atheist, those are the only places you can go to. You can say it's sort of hardwired, that our beliefs about certain things being right or wrong, that these things are hardwired into us by a process of selection. Or you can say that it has something to do with society. But either one of those claims, the claim that murder is wrong, doesn't really give you the claim that it's actually morally wrong. It gives you this helped our ancestors, this rule helped our ancestors survive, this instinct, whatever. And this is a rule that societies have accepted. But those don't give you the idea that murder is actually morally wrong. So when a naturalist or an atheist is making claims that so-and-so is a bad person and this is really wrong, this is really bad. They're not saying what they should be saying if they're really naturalists. They're not saying, oh, this is so-and-so is bad in the sense that that sort of thing should be, that sort of view that he has, or those things that he does, those shouldn't be hardwired into him to do that sort of thing. That should have been weeded out by natural selection. That's not what he means, right? Atheist and the skeptic, when they're saying that these things are bad or that these things are evil, they mean they're really bad and they're really evil in the moral sense. And so in doing that, they're saying that they have, one, that the evil things do exist, and that presupposes that naturalism and atheism are false. And they're saying that they have access to them, which is saying that we're not the sort of things that we should be if naturalism were true. We're not just this continuation of the process of evolution. We're in a completely different category.
Yeah. I think one of the examples I'm thinking of, so we're in a different category, is Allie and I are cat owners. And so if we see Shiro, our cat, scratching the couch, for instance, we can't pick him up and say, now, Shiro, you need to learn that our furniture here costs money, and we value its well-being, and we therefore ask that you don't scratch your claws, or instead use this nicer scratching post that we got you. The most we could do is say no, or maybe get out a squirt bottle filled with water and squirt him every single time, because if we just try and give him a moral lecture on it, he's a cat. He's not going to understand it. Now, on the other hand,
there's no concept there. And what you'd be doing with the squirt bottle or whatever is trying to rewire your cat so that your cat associates that sort of clawing with some mm-hmm. bad consequence of getting squirt with a bottle or something like that.
Yeah.
So there we understand. And that's all you really should mean if you're a naturalist or an atheist. When someone's doing something bad, when someone's doing these bad things, is they're kind of like your cat. They weren't wired properly, and so now we got to try and tweak them a little bit and try and get a better result. But that's not when the atheist is arguing from the problem of evil. They're saying that these things are really so bad that they conflict with the existence of a really good being, and that's just it's total opposite of what they should be saying.
Well, we've actually got someone who's just now called in, and I'm going to take the call, but I think what I'll do first is I'll play a commercial, and after that we come back. Are you willing to take a call on this question?
Sure. Take all the calls you want.
Okay. We're going to take a break, and call them when you get back. I'll be taking your call. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
And I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. Our guest is Dr. David Wood. We've already got one caller waiting. Our call-in number is 714-242-5180 if you want to join in. So right now I'm going to put our caller on the air. And caller, you are on the air with Dr. David Wood.
Hello, is this me?
Yep.
Okay, sorry, just making sure. Hi, my name is Brandon. I'm from Portland. I just called because what I just heard about talking about how when a naturalist uses the problem of evil, they presuppose a standard of evil that you guys say relies on theism itself. And I was wondering, couldn't such an argument just be a reductio? You know, you assume the person's worldview in order to show that it leads to absurdities or contradictions. That seems more like what the naturalist would be doing with the problem of evil.
By the way, that is the typical response when you say, "Look, by claiming that there is evil, you're presupposing this standard of of right and wrong, good and evil, and that conflicts with your own worldview. The standard response is, no, I'm simply stepping into your worldview, and I'm pointing out this contradiction in your worldview. You're the one claiming that this perfect being exists, and you as a Christian believe that moral evil exists. And so you've got this problem here. But me, I don't really believe that this stuff is and here comes the problem. If the atheist or naturalist wants to go that route, what he has to maintain is, I'm not really saying this stuff is evil in any sort of objective sense. I'm not saying it's evil or right and wrong or, you know, right or wrong in that sense. I'm simply saying that according to your worldview, it would be this. And the reason that doesn't work is there can be things that are bad from our perspective that aren't really bad on either worldview, right? So according to Christianity, I can believe that certain things are bad and they're not actually bad. I could be wrong about certain things. And from the naturalist point of view, if he really takes naturalism seriously, all our beliefs about, you know, genuine moral evil are in that category. We're just wrong about them. So the problem is that the naturalist has to be able to identify things that are so wrong that they could not exist if the sort of being that Christians maintain exists were real. And so they have to be able to identify those things. But if you're a naturalist, you're dealing with faculties, you're dealing with abilities that the only reason you think the way you do is that you developed in that certain way. Again, if you're trying to explain how we are the way we are, from a naturalistic perspective, all you can say is the way I'm wired right now, at some point it helped my ancestors survive and reproduce. Those are the only two criteria, survival and reproduction. So you have to explain why we think about moral things in terms of some sort of survival advantage or some sort of reproductive advantage. That's all that natural selection favors. So unless it's just some sort of biological accident. So there can be biological accidents that didn't, you know, they weren't selected for any reason, you just ended up with them. So you've got, it helped us survive, it helped us reproduce, or it's just some sort of biological accident. Well, none of those things would give you the sort of reliable moral reasoning capacity to say, I can identify things that would not exist if theism were true. In other words, he's stepping into my worldview, but he's still using the same reasoning abilities that he believes he has on naturalism. He's still using his own mind. But in saying that he's using his own reasoning ability, which is produced just for its ability to survive and reproduce, how does he get to the ability to make claims about good and evil in some ultimate sense that would even apply to God? In other words, think about it like this. The sorts of things that help us survive and reproduce, they're pretty straightforward. They're usually grounded in things that we can just sort of directly observe. In other words, you know, surviving. I can have reliable reasoning ability about finding berries or using a spear against an enemy or doing something to attract a mate. And I can be right about those things, and if my brain is wired in that way and it leads to certain behaviors, then I might have an advantage over other organisms that are wired differently and don't have those behaviors. But when you're talking about this sort of right and wrong in this ultimate sense that would even apply to a being that is vastly beyond us, the naturalist really, if he's really takes his naturalism seriously, cannot say that he even has the ability to identify in our worldview. He doesn't have the ability to look into our worldview and say, this is something that a perfect being could not allow. And that's why, because he has to have the ability to identify those sorts of things, and the ability to identify those sorts of things presupposes that he has reliable moral reasoning faculties, that he is the sort of being who can say what is right and what is wrong in this ultimate sense that would even apply to God. And as a naturalist, I just don't see how you can maintain that. In other words, when you say, here is something that God could not allow, what you're, even in making that claim, you're saying that you're something far beyond what you could possibly be on naturalism. You can't make that sort of claim on naturalism. And if you, well, you can make the claim, but you can't take it seriously. You can't take it seriously as a claim. And so even in making the claim, you're presupposing that you're something more than you would be, on naturalism if you took your worldview seriously. And so even in making the argument that the atheist or the naturalist is using our worldview, he's appealing to what he is on our worldview. He's using a Christian worldview of what he is in order to argue against us. So it's not, I'm just stepping into your worldview. If you're a real naturalist, you can't do that. You can't do that because, you don't. It's like a 3-foot person saying, I'm going to step into the world of a 6-foot person. You can't do it. You can't know what it's like to do that. You don't have that ability. And so it's not just, hey, I'm just giving you a critique of the inconsistencies in your worldview. Even to offer those inconsistencies or to understand what's right and wrong, you have to be a certain sort of thing. And the naturalist isn't what he's claiming in that.
Am I still here? Could I follow up on that?
Yeah, sure.
I was wondering what you think about the naturalist appealing to belief in like knowledge, like about moral facts being properly basic, like numbers having a reality. So just like our beliefs in, say, the external world or other minds or the laws of logic or induction are properly basic, and we can have warrant in believing them until there's feeders for them, we could also have belief in basic moral facts because we all seem to believe them, and then they seem to be right, and that's properly basic, and until we find a feeder for certain things like love is good or suffering is bad, that we can just rationally hold them just like you can rationally hold the belief in other minds or the laws of logic or the reality of numbers. Some naturalists find it consistent with their worldview that numbers have a sort of reality as abstract objects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a great point, and lots of atheists would make that point. And just for everyone out there, just to review really quick, we do have an understanding of certain right and certain claims are about moral goodness, moral badness, and so on. We do have a right, even as naturalists or as atheists, to maintain those claims until we have some reason to doubt them, until we have some good reason to think that they're false. And the point is, if you're a naturalist, you have a defeater. You already have a if you say naturalism is true, you already have a defeater for those moral claims. And it doesn't mean that as a naturalist you've thought this through and that you realize you have a defeater. It means that, in other words, this is kind of the reverse of the argument from evil. When the atheist uses the argument from evil, he's saying, you Christians, you haven't thought this through, and you haven't thought about how these two beliefs that you maintain conflict with each other, and you have to drop one of them. Well, we have something similar, analogous, in the world of naturalism, that the naturalist believes he is capable, he's capable of moral reasoning, and that he is aware of all these moral facts about the world, but he doesn't realize there's something else in his beliefs that provides a defeater for this, that something else he believes makes those other claims false. And what the naturalist believes is, and he believes in the only sort of route that you could possibly have on naturalism for getting to where he is. And so if you're a naturalist and you say, here are certain things that I believe, you can call them properly basic, you can call them whatever you want, here are certain things that I believe are moral facts about the world. From a naturalistic perspective, how did you come to those beliefs about what's right and what's wrong about the world? Well, again, you only have two places you can possibly go. As a naturalist, you can say, I was hardwired to think this way, and that my ancestors, who tended to think this way, survived better. In other words, the wiring that led to certain behaviors, that gave certain ancestors a survival advantage. Or you can say that it's something that humans eventually agreed on, that we agreed on it in society or something like that. Those are the only places you could go to appeal for why you believe these certain things. And the problem is, neither one of those, neither one of those could you take. In other words, once you understand that, once you understand the source, the only possible sources of your moral views, you can't take them. You can't take them as undeniably true. You can't certainly can't take them as things that would apply to God. Because again, if I say I'm hardwired to believe in a certain way, we could have been hardwired all kinds of different ways, right? Suppose there had been a mutation a long time ago in early humans. Suppose there had been a mutation and women refused to have sex, right? They just became repulsed by sex, and they refused to have it. No matter, you couldn't bribe them; they would not do it. If that had happened, the only men that would pass on their genetic information would be rapists, right? And think about it. If this were to proceed, where women have this genetic just complete reluctance to have sex, the only men who would be passing on their genetic information would be rapists. Well, what's the next generation? The next generation is a bunch of guys who it's the offspring of guys who are hardwired to have less respect for women or to treat women differently from guys who just happen to be hardwired to have more respect for women. If this were to continue through generation after generation of women having a mutation that they refuse to have sex and men having sex with them anyway, well, who, over and over again, generation after generation, who's going to pass on the most offspring? Who's going to leave the most offspring? Well, it would be the guys who are the biggest rapists, the guys who rape the most. Well, think about this. If this happened, and, you know, this is just hypothetical, if this happened after thousands of years, tons of generations, the only sort of people you're going to end up with are going to be people who are hardwired to be as horrible a rapist as possible. If you ask these people, is rape right? Of course it's right. They think that way. And in fact, they could defend it intellectually. Right? They could say, well, if we didn't do this, our species would end. It's beneficial to the species to be going out and raping as many women as possible because women just refuse to have sex. So we have to do this. So they could defend it in all kinds of ways, and they would be wired to do things in a certain way. But I wouldn't say that that makes rape objectively right or that it makes it properly basic. All you could say in that situation is the role that it played. You can refer to the role that it played that has nothing to do with whether it's objectively right or objectively wrong. It just played a certain role in the history of humanity. And so you can't appeal to the way we develop, because we could have been, you know, some people develop, they're hardwired and they end up more violent. Some people are less violent. Animals, certainly, a lion will kill competing offspring and so on. We're hardwired to do certain things in certain ways. But you can't get any real moral facts out of that. It's just that's the way it is. And similarly, you can't get it from society. You can't say, well, my society teaches this, and therefore that's right, because societies teach completely different things. And so as a naturalist, once you're aware of the origin of these moral facts you believe, I believe that there are moral facts, then once you understand the only places you can go to explain those moral facts, you realize either way they undermine whether these facts are moral facts. And you end up with, I'm just calling them facts, but they're not really facts. And so the point here is the atheist or the naturalist has a conflict. It's pretty rare to find someone that you couldn't pin down to say that something is really right or really wrong. But generally, the vast majority of atheists and naturalists are saying things that are wrong left and right. Christianity is bad. It's evil. Christians are bad. Christians are this. Christians are that. Atheists are good. All these things are good and bad, and they're making moral claims left and right. They're making every bit as many moral claims as a Christian would maintain. But those are in conflict. All those claims that they're making are in conflict with what they actually believe about the world. And so again, it's sort of the reverse of the problem of evil, in that they haven't thought through this. The atheist who's saying it's bad for God to allow such and such to happen, he doesn't realize that him making that claim, him believing that statement is true, conflicts with what he claims to believe about himself. And so that would be, that's part of the point of apologetics, is to bring these conflicts to the surface.
Well, thank you.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, for now. I mean, I had more, but I don't want to hog. I don't want to hog your time.
Okay.
But
well, I do thank you for calling in.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye. Now, David, I was thinking about that one claim that we often get from atheists is that you don't need to believe in God to be a good person. And I think what you had said would kind of deal with that, because you don't need to believe in God to know these moral truths that you talk about, to know the problem of evil. But knowing God does give you a foundation to explain them.
Yeah, it's important to point that out, because when you start saying that, hey, if naturalism is true, then here's the origin of our moral beliefs, there is no real right or wrong on this claim. The immediate response is, oh, you're saying we're bad and you're good. No, not what I'm saying at all. An atheist can go out and be the nicest person in the world. He could love his neighbor as himself all his life. In other words, he could obey almost every command in Christianity. He couldn't obey, you know, the commands to worship and stuff like that. But as far as how he's supposed to go out and live in the world, he could live exactly like a Christian, apart from the going to, you know, well, he could go to church and so on, but you know, certain acts of devotion towards God, he couldn't do those as an atheist, So, and by the way, atheists do agree with us on a ton of moral claims about the universe. So that's not the point. The point is not you as an atheist are doing really bad things. You can do all the things you want, but here's the point: you can also live like a frog, right? You can go out and live like a frog. We could all go out right now, sit down on a lily pad and eat flies all day. We could live like that. Is that a better way to live? And that's the point. If you, as an atheist, are living a life of extreme benevolence and helping people, and that you've dedicated your life to philanthropy, is that a morally better life than, you know, the person who sits around and, you know, just has sex all the time and tries to pass on as many offspring as possible? What do you even mean? What do you mean if you say it's a better life? What do you mean? I mean, if you're talking about how evolution works, the person who's passing on as many offspring as possible is living a better life in that sense. But that's got nothing to do with morality. That's just how things are working. So when we're talking about the moral difference here, the moral difference isn't in how people are living. The moral difference is what's the foundation? I can say and be completely consistent with my worldview, this person over here is living a better life than that person over there. As an atheist or as a naturalist, that claim, if you really think about it, makes no sense. What sense are you talking about? And I find that what atheists often mean, and they don't realize it, is this person over here is good or better because he's actually living by a bunch of values that we got from Christianity, and this person over here is bad because that person is living against the values we got from Christianity and have been, you know, worked their way into our society. But they don't realize it. They don't realize that's where they ultimately got their moral claims from. Because again, I pointed out, you know, certain things, herd instinct and so on, those can be hardwired into us. But a lot of what we believe, it just comes down through society, and Christianity has just had a huge impact on our society. So a lot of what we believe about right and wrong actually comes from Christianity, the belief that all men are created equal. You didn't get that from Aristotle. You didn't get that from Plato. They would say, "What the heck are you talking about? What sense does that make? We're not equal in strength. We're not equal in intelligence. What do you mean we're all created equal?" It's a Christian sense in which we're all created by God, and we're equal in that sense. That's what that sort of thing means, and it's things that anyone would tell you they believe, and they don't realize the ultimate origin of a lot of what we believe. And so they're making all these claims about right and wrong, and good and bad, and so-and-so's a good person, you can't say I'm a bad person, this and that. You don't realize that everything on their worldview, those claims don't make sense. Those claims are presupposing a Christian concept of morality.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back to discuss this further with Dr. David Wood.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
And we're back with Dr. David Wood, and as you probably know, the problem of evil is a really big topic. It's too much to cover on one show. Fortunately, we're going to be discussing it again next week, and to discuss it next week, my guest will be Dr. Greg Ganser, who I'm sure David Wood's familiar with. He'll be on...
Oh, he's the man.
What?
I said he's the man.
Oh, well, he'll be on here next week, so if you all like this show, be sure to listen next week. Now, Dr. Wood, I wanted to ask, you've said that God is the, gives us a basis, as it were, for knowing good and evil. How does that work exactly?
Well, it's I always tend to think of these things in terms of competing worldviews. But you know, the traditional Christian claim is that we've been created in the image of God, and part of what that means to be created in the image of God is that we do have some awareness of our Creator, and we do have some awareness of these sort of spiritual matters. And, you know, these things can be warped. They can be warped through sin or whatever. But we do maintain that, that image. And so we're all kind of in the same situation in that, you know, we all have certain experiences, whether atheists or theists or whatever. We all have certain experiences of the world. We believe, you know, in our experience of the outside world and of other people, but not just of what we get by the senses. We also believe in, you know, laws of logic and moral values and so on. And the question is, you know, what worldview actually makes sense of these things? And what you'll find is that, you know, the atheist is saying Christianity or theism can't make sense of evil. Even if we granted that, even if we said you're right, boy, it doesn't make sense that there's so much suffering if theism is true. Even if we granted that, theism does really well with everything else, right? It explains the origin of the universe. It explains why we have complex life. It explains why humans have these unique abilities, why we have consciousness and so on in the human sense. It explains logical laws. It explains moral values. It explains the uniformity of nature. Theism can account for all of these things, and the atheist is saying, but it doesn't account for this one thing over here. Well, naturalism, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't explain anything, right? Naturalism can't account for a rock, as far as I'm concerned. So if we're talking about, you know, how theism and naturalism compete in terms of explanatory power, even if we said theism has a problem with explaining the abundance of suffering in our world, you don't throw out a hypothesis, you don't throw out a hypothesis or a theory or an ideology that accounts for everything really well, just because you say, well, it doesn't account for this over here, especially when its main competitor, which is naturalism, fails to account for anything. So as far as theism, it's not that we're deeply aware of how God is, you know, communicating in a moral sense to us or something like this. It's we've been created as that kind of being. We've been created as beings who know certain things about right and wrong. Again, it can be twisted. We can twist it. But we do have this basic sense in that we try to do right and we try not to do wrong. And we understand that other people have rights, things like that. So on theism, it's that we've been created as certain kinds of beings. And that's kind of the reason it conflicts with naturalism. If naturalism is true, we're not those kinds of beings. We're actually beings who have kind of illusions. We have illusions that certain things are right and wrong, and those illusions are based on how our ancestors developed or on how society has taught us to think. But those moral values don't correspond to anything outside of that, whereas according to theism, the moral values do correspond to something outside of our development.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked also about so much evil. So when we get to the problem itself, I mean, let's use an example, for instance. When the picture that my wife submitted for our use today was based on 9/11. And most of us remember 9/11 very well. I was in Bible college. I could tell you where I was sitting when we heard the call before 9 p.m. and someone came in and right before a service and said, or 9 a.m. right before a service and said, we've just heard that a plane has hit the World Trade Center. And at that moment, I don't think many of us were thinking, terrorist attack. I mean, oh my gosh, some tragedies happened. And then
when I heard about the first plane, I was thinking, oh man, drunk pilot.
And then when we got done the service, we heard about the second one. It's like, okay, now we're no longer talking about coincidence. And a bunch of us were in downstairs lobby watching the news, and we saw when the towers fell. And I mean, to this day, my wife still spared the number of 9/11 together. So we can just ask, how can a good God let 9/11 happen?
Well, there's all kinds of there's all kinds of different routes that that theists take here. You have philosophical responses to these. These are called theodicies. And here, it's not theodicies aren't usually associated with any particular religion. This is the philosopher trying to reconcile the claims that God could have reasons for allowing things like 9/11. So here, he's not saying anything from a Christian perspective. It's just given the claim that the universe was created by a being who is perfect in power, perfect in knowledge, perfect in goodness, why could he allow it? Those sorts of explanations are called theodicies. But you can also have different sort of explanations that would derive from a more particular religion, so Christianity or Islam, for instance. So just to give you an idea, a theodicy, and there are dozens of different theodicies.
Yeah.
There are dozens of different explanations that a philosopher might give. Might say, here's God's reason for allowing this, but just to appeal to some of the more common kinds. The most common theodicy as far as moral evil, and just for people who weren't here earlier, moral evil would be evil that results from the intentions of some of some person, some human being in this instant. This isn't 9/11 is people deciding to fly planes into a building. If the plane had been flying by and a storm hit and crashed it into the World Trade Center, it'd be a completely different story. But here we're talking about people deliberately killing thousands of people. So this would be, why would God allow moral evil? And here, theodicies aren't tremendously popular among some philosophers. They're more popular with others. So this is, in other words, don't think that I'm giving a response that all philosophers would agree with. This is an example that some philosophers would appeal to. It is called a free will theodicy, namely that that free will is important. And if people have seen the movie The Stepford Wives, it was a good illustration of this. There are two versions. There was one that was a horror movie, and then there's one that was more recent. It was a comedy. But in the town of Stepford, if you move there, you take your wife that might have. She's not everything you would like her to be. You would like her to behave different in some way. And so you're to take her to this town, and in the original they would actually replace them with robots. But in the newer one they would just put like a chip in their brain that would make them behave in a certain way. And the idea is that you go to this town and your wife gets reprogrammed to behave exactly as you want her to behave. So you tell the doctor exactly what you want. and then your wife becomes the perfect ideal wife that you would like to have. And the question is, the sort of question is that better? Is it better to have a wife who does everything you want her to do at all times? Or is it better to have a wife who isn't that sort of wife, but at least she's not just doing it because you've programmed her? And most people would say that it's better to have a real wife and not to have a wife who's been programmed, because for real wives, when your wife does something nice, it's not because you programmed her. It was because of her free will. She decided to do that sort of thing. And so the reasoning here is that freely performed right actions are better. They're more valuable than the same action performed without the free will. In other words, because something has been programmed to behave in a certain way. So the theodicy here is that God has given human beings free will because he values freely performed right actions. But the cost is, if you're giving people actual free will and not some fake free will, where I'm going to give you free will as long as you only do right things, but then I'm going to jump in there and stop you whenever you're doing something wrong, that wouldn't actually be free will, is that in order to give us actual free will, he has to give us the ability to do wrong things. And so what you have, according to this theodicy, is God gives us a lot of freedom. We can't do certain things. We can't slaughter the entire world just by thinking about it. But we can do quite a bit. And so God, according to this theodicy, leaves a lot of it up to us. He gives us the ability to fly planes into buildings. He also gives us the ability to stand against that sort of thing and to, you know, fight against terrorists and stop them. But that this sort of world, a world where we can decide what we're going to do, is better than a world where you don't have 9/11, you don't have terrorists attacking, but you also don't have the free will to do that sort of thing. God doesn't allow us to have that sort of freedom. And, you know, lots of people would say, well, God should take away our freedom to do that sort of bad thing. But, you know, you can do a little test, and, you know, some people do have that view. But you can do a little test here, and you can say, look, if you had a button right now, and if you push that button, there would be no more 9/11s. There would be no more Holocaust. There would be none of these really bad things. But none of us gets to really freely choose what we're going to do in any significant sense anymore. Would you push that button? And some people will say yes, and some people will say no. Here, what's important is not where we whether we agree or disagree or what we think. The question is, if you're an atheist or if you're a naturalist, can you say that free will is not that important? You can say you don't find it that important, but can you say, as a naturalist who developed his reasoning ability because his ancestors survived and reproduced more than others, can you say, I know for certain that free will is not important enough to allow human beings to do really bad things to each other? And I don't see how you can. As an atheist or a naturalist, I don't see how you can maintain that claim given what you're saying about your own status. Your moral views, if you're a naturalist or an atheist, came from a fundamentally unreliable process as far as producing reliable moral faculties about what a perfect being should and shouldn't do. You're not made for that sort of thing on naturalism. You're made to find food. You're made to find a mate. That's what you're made to do. That's what you're designed by nature to do. You are made to do those certain things. You are not made, according to naturalism, to figure out these truths, these moral truths, about something that is so far beyond us that you're not made for that purpose. So you can't make these sorts of claims. So the point is, whether some people like the theodicy, some people don't like the theodicy, the question is, because this is in response to an argument coming from an atheist or naturalist, the problem of evil. And in this particular, we're giving a particular instance of evil. Why would God allow 9/11? Atheists can say, I don't see why God would allow 9/11. Well, if you're really saying that the theist has a problem, if you're really saying theists have a problem here, and there's a conflict in our beliefs, you can't just say, God wouldn't do that. You have to say, God wouldn't do that because there's no reason for God to allow that. And to say there's no reason for God to allow that, you have to say, well, these things that are offered in theodicies, they're not really that important. Well, you know, I can, on the one hand, I kind of see that. I kind of see, hey, should God just let us be doing all this horrible, bad stuff? That's one thing. I see the atheist point there. And just for the record, there are all kinds of theodicies that I don't find tremendously persuasive. But when we're sort of stepping into the atheist's worldview, as it were, it's not clear how an atheist, given what he believes about the world, can speak with confidence on denying these theodicies. So in other words, in this situation, the burden of proof on the atheist who's claiming that we have some fundamental incoherence in our beliefs, that's his argument, right? So theists have arguments, right? We have the design argument, cosmological argument, argument for miracles, yeah. Things like that. We have our arguments, and when we have our arguments on the table, we have to defend our premises and defend our logic. Well, here's a situation where it's the atheist's argument, and so he has to defend his premises. Well, part of his argument then needs to be that a perfectly good being could have no morally sufficient reason for allowing certain things. And I just don't see how any naturalist who really understands what he believes, who really understands what he's claiming about his origins, can say with any degree of confidence that that he knows that his claim that God couldn't have reasons for allowing suffering is true. The atheist will never be able to defend as a premise what he needs to defend as a premise. And the problem there is, when we offer our arguments for theism, if we don't prove a premise with 100% certainty, the atheist will throw out the entire argument. Well, an atheist can't defend almost anything he needs to defend the argument from evil, various versions of the problem of evil. But they have kind of shifting standards. When we're arguing against the existence of God, anything is good enough to qualify as a clear argument. And when the theist is offering an argument for theism, well, any reason to dismiss the argument is a full justification for throwing out the argument forever. So anyway, that's an example. There are many more of philosophical responses. If you're, let's say, a Christian or even a Muslim or a Jew here, you could be giving a completely different kind of response. You could say, for instance, if you're talking about 9/11, you could say, look, human beings are in rebellion against God. We sin all the time. We're horribly selfish. What sense does it make to say that God should be rushing down to help us like a superhero whenever anything is going wrong? This is when we think about how perfect this being is, we understand how bad we are by comparison. What sense does it make to think that he is supposed to give us this perfect? This is the being that we're rebelling against. This is the being that we're saying we don't want anything to do with you. And then we don't want anything to do with you until something goes wrong. Then we want you to come in and rescue us. Then once you've rescued us, you leave, and then we go back to rebelling against you. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense from a Christian perspective. So as a Christian, you wouldn't even need, you know, a free will theodicy or something like that. You could say, look, human beings sin, and God is under no obligation when people sin against him and want to live apart from him. In other words, if we want to live apart from him, then we kind of have to live with the consequences of living apart from him, and part of that is we're going to do horrible things to each other. And so this would be a completely different kind of response. This wouldn't be a response that a philosopher who's just trying to defend theism would use, but it's something that would be internal to Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I see how Carter has called back, but before I do that, I'm going to take a quick break, and so those on hold, just wait here, and we'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gift if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And I'd like to remind everyone that indeed what we do here is listener-supported. So please make a donation to Blog Talk Radio. And also what I do here at Deeper Waters is listener supported. And you can make a donation to me through my blog site at deeperwaters.wordpress.com, or you can go through the Ratio Christi Issues and Answers chapter. Any donation you make to us will be greatly appreciated and worthwhile. And now I'm going to get back to our David Witt, and we've got a caller who'd like to ask a question, so I'm going to put him on the air now. So, Carter, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call again. I hope it's okay for me to call in twice.
Yes, mate, give us a quick question here.
Yeah, of course. I was wondering, when you say that as one of the theodicies of the problem of you, like when atheist says, say for example, an all-loving, all-powerful, all-knowledgeable God cannot allow certain instances of suffering. You say, well, we just are not in a position to know why God would do that. We just can't. Us being humans cannot comprehend the reasons, the morally sufficient reasons God may have for allowing such evils in the world. How would you then not know if God is, say, lying to you about certain things that you get from special revelation, like the qualifications for salvation, things like that, which come from special revelation alone? Couldn't God also have morally sufficient reasons that we just can't comprehend to lie to us about those things?
Just to clarify, there's a position that would apply to that's called skeptical theism. A skeptical theist would say that we just don't have access to God's reasons, and there's a good basis for skeptical theism, namely the difference in the intellectual abilities of human beings versus the intellectual abilities of God. God knows everything. If we really tried to estimate how much we know collectively as human beings, we'd have to say we know a very, very tiny fraction of what can be known. In other words, if you thought of everything that can possibly be known about the world, past, present, future, how much of that would we know? It's not a lot. And so the reasoning behind skeptical theism is, you can give an example. If you take a 1-year-old who can't speak, and you take him to give him a shot, and I'm bringing this up because I actually had to do this. You take a 1-year-old and give him a shot, and the doctor is jabbing him with needles. Well, the 1-year-old doesn't understand the reason for being jabbed with needles. And so from the perspective of a 1-year-old, hey, here's my dad holding me down while a doctor jabs me with needles. If the 1-year-old could formulate an argument, it would be, if my dad really loved me, then he wouldn't be allowing this to happen. Therefore, my dad doesn't really love me because this is happening. And it would just be wrong. It would be based on the ignorance of a 1-year-old in comparison with our knowledge, where we have access to more important things. So anyway, that's an analogy there. The difference between the intellectual abilities of a 1-year-old versus a grown adult would actually be a smaller distance than the distance between a full-grown human being, let's say a full-grown, very educated human being, and God. And so the reasoning behind skeptical theism is, since we have so little access to why God would do anything, we don't really know. We don't really know, and maybe we can't say, and we don't have to say, because if God did have reasons for allowing all of this, we would have no reason to think that we would have access to God's reasons. Since we don't have access to God's reasons, we shouldn't be surprised that we can't think of reasons. We aren't aware of all the things that God's aware of, and so we're skeptical in the sense. This is why it's called skeptical theism. We're theists. We believe in God, but we're skeptical of our abilities to know why God does certain things. And if you're going to do, if that was the position, that's again skeptical theism. If that's the position, I think you could say, well, how do you know God's not doing all these other things that you just don't have awareness of his reasons for doing? He could be doing all kinds of other things. He could be tricking us all the time, as Descartes' evil demon hypothesis would put it. But that's not actually what I was saying with response to the in response to the atheist or the naturalist. The point I was making there is that if a theist offers a theodicy in response to the question, what reason could God have for allowing this? So if the atheist says, look at 9/11, look at that evil, God should have stopped it, any good God would have stopped it. A being that actually cares about us and is powerful enough would have stopped that, but he didn't stop that. I'm not appealing to skeptical theism. We don't know why God would allow it. I'm saying a theist in that situation could appeal to various theodicies. One of the theodicies the theist could appeal to is the free will theodicy. So the theist could say that God values free will. He values freely performed right actions. And since he values our freely performed right actions, he gives us free will, even though we often misuse that free will. What I'm saying is if that's true, if that claim is true, if the theist position is true, then you've explained the evil. You've just explained why God would allow this. I'm not defending the theodicy, by the way. I'm giving an example of the theodicy. So there, the point is, theism is irrational because it can't account for why God didn't stop the 9/11 attacks. The point I was offering about not knowing why God would do certain things, there I was talking about from the perspective of a naturalist. So earlier you were saying, what if the naturalist just steps into the theist worldview? Here I'm talking about stepping into the naturalist worldview. And so the claim I'm making is, if a theist responds, here's why God does this. God does this because he values our free will. When the atheist or the naturalist says, no, that's not good enough. I don't think God should give us that sort of free will. I think it would be wrong to give us that free will, knowing that we're going to misuse it in so many ways. My point about being skeptical was from the atheist worldview. Namely, if you're an atheist or a naturalist, why should I even take that claim seriously, given what you believe about your origins and the origins of your moral views? So in other words, when the atheist says, I don't find that theodicy persuasive, or I don't think free will is that important, the question really is, who cares? You're a naturalist. According to your worldview, the origin of your moral values is, again, survival and reproduction and indoctrination by society. Why should I think that that can provide you with a serious critical evaluation of a theodicy of what God would value, right? So in other words, how would you know how important free will is to God if you're a naturalist? If you're really a naturalist, if you're serious and there are serious naturalists. There are naturalists who are offering serious responses. If you're not just the sort of whiny, contradictory naturalist who's just I'll say anything to refute theism right now. If you're really serious, you can't say as a naturalist that you can say what would be important to God or not, right? Not in that sense. Not if it's something we can take seriously, right? If you want to say, God wanted the 9/11 attacks to happen because he wanted a different building there or something like that. He wanted the Freedom Tower, and he wanted to see that happen. Well, there it's not something that anyone would take seriously. But free will is something that people do take seriously. And so that, in other words, it's something that's plausible in a certain sense of it. It's something that we all regard as, or most of us regard as, very important. So if we're saying, here's something that human beings in general find pretty darn important, not taking away our free will, letting us go out and do certain things, the question is, how important is it to God? Well, we can say, I don't think it's that important to God, or we could say, no, I think it's very, very important to God. The point is, from a naturalistic perspective, you're in no position to say, no, that theodicy is wrong. So here, I'm not saying God might have reasons for all kinds of reasons for doing things that we're not aware of. I'm not saying that. I'm saying from the position of a naturalist, we don't have access to if God did have values of certain things, if God did value free will or something like that, the naturalist is in no position to say what God would value in that sense, and therefore he's in no position to say that the theist has a contradictory set of beliefs, because he can't defend one of the premises. One of his premises would be that God doesn't have reasons for allowing these things. And in order to defend that premise, he'd have to show that these theodicies fail and that there couldn't be other reasons for allowing it. And the atheist or the naturalist is just never going to be able to show that he's in any kind of position in order to defend any of these claims. And so there it's showing that really that naturalists just aren't in a good position to be arguing from evil.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. Bye.
Thank you. You know what, Dr. Wood, one other aspect I think we should touch on is you talked about natural evil some, and you've debated John Loftus, and I actually debated him on Theology Web one time after Hurricane Katrina struck. So there's an example of natural evil. Say, okay, well, we can understand the free will defense for Muslim terrorists, but Muslims don't have anything to do with what happened in Hurricane Katrina. Why does God allow something like Hurricane Katrina then?
Well, here again, there are sort of two categories that you can go. The third category would be more skeptical theism, which again, it certainly has something going for it, in that there is a huge gulf between our knowledge and God's knowledge. And so, you know, at the end of the day, if someone wants to say, hey, I believe in God, but since I believe in God, I also have to believe that I can't be aware of his reasons for doing certain things. If a person goes that route, there's really nothing you could say about evil that would refute the existence of God for that person. But as a caller just pointed out, that also comes with a cost. If you're going to say that the universe is created by a being who could do all sorts of things that we just see no reason for, we have to figure out, you know, are there any limits to that? You know, could he be deceiving us or something like that? So that's sort of the third category. But the two common approaches would be the philosophical approach of theodicy, offering some reconciliation of the claims that God exists and that Hurricane Katrina happened, and on the other hand, a response that is more particular to a certain religion. Why would God, if the God of that particular religion, if that whole religion, if that religious position is true, why might God allow that sort of thing? And here the situation would be similar in respect to the religious response. But if you're talking about natural evil, here, again, there are dozens of theodicies, but the most common, as far as moral evil is concerned, is what we already talked about, free will. God values free will. The most common theodicy, so a response that a philosopher might give, the most common theodicy as far as natural evil is concerned would be what's called a soul-building theodicy. That goes something like this. If you look back at your life, you think about the times that you grew as a human being, the times that you developed, spiritually and morally, they're usually not the times when everything was going well. You usually grow spiritually or morally when times are rough, when you have to go through something. So the idea here is, you know, you don't become a hero by not going through anything. You become a hero by facing some very important challenges in your life. So the theodicy, and here again with both the free will theodicy and the soul-building theodicy, the reason that these became popular is that they both rely on something that, whether you're an atheist or a theist, you'd sort of grant the general idea that there's a kernel of truth, regardless of whether you ultimately agree with the theodicy or not. People generally recognize the importance of free will and not programming people to believe in certain things. We would think it's wrong to take a human being and brainwash that person into believing certain things. Most people would find that wrong, and so people grant the importance of free will. And so what the theodicy does is it takes something that we find important and say, and then applies that to a category of evil and says, here's why God might allow this, because we agree that this is important. And then the debate from there is it important enough? Is free will important enough that God might allow things like 9/11 or the Holocaust to occur? And that's where the debate is going to come down to. With respect to natural evil, the theodicy is that the sort of world we live in is the sort of world where you can have development in virtue, development in, you know, in this, our sort of spiritual side, because we have to go through stuff. And you can contrast this with the sort of world that, you know, certain atheists might want. You know, it's a hedonistic paradise. Nothing should ever go wrong. It's a world of nonstop, endless pleasure. Well, a world of nonstop, endless pleasure is not the sort of world where people are going to develop ever, right? I mean, you know, usually people who just have everything given to them, they don't turn out to be good people. They turn out to be the most horrible people you've ever met in your life. So the reasoning here is that in order to become certain sorts of people, we need a world that's kind of like ours, in that it's a world that we have to go through some significant struggles and challenges. So if we're going to become courageous people, then we have to face dangers. If we're going to become compassionate people, then, you know, there has to be suffering. So, you know, the response to this sort of theodicy is going to be, you know, does this justify? Does God really make lots of poor people so that other people can show compassion? And there, it's not. This is more of a global theodicy, in that it's not God allows that particular instance of suffering so that this other person can come along and be compassionate about it. The idea is more global. It's that God gives us a certain kind of world, and that this world is governed by certain natural laws, and that there are going to be things that go wrong in this world, and we're going to have to face those, and that it's better for us to have these sorts of challenges than a static world of nonstop pleasure where we don't go through anything, but we also don't develop in any moral or spiritual sense. So that's sort of the general idea of what a theodicy in response to natural evil would look like. But here again, you could also, from a religious perspective, if we're talking about Christianity or Islam or Judaism, you could say, here again, look, the universe, I mean, this world or this universe was not built to function completely independently of God. According to theism, God doesn't just start it off. God is actually sustaining everything that exists for as long as it exists. And so from a theistic perspective, this world, everything that's happening, it all depends on God. And so from a theistic perspective, you could say, from a Christian perspective, you could say that as human beings rebel against God, that, you know, God can withdraw some of that sustaining power. Things sort of start winding down. In other words, if we want to live independently of God, God gives us an idea of what it's like for him not to be there, for him not to constantly be protecting and sustaining us and so on. And so there, from that perspective, you could say God's under no obligation as a perfect being to make sure everything goes right, to make sure that no earthquakes happen, to make sure that there are no tornadoes, to make sure that the laws of nature always turn out for our benefit and never harm us. That God's under no obligation to do that sort of things to people who rebel against him. And so here again, completely different ways of thinking. And by the way, these aren't mutually exclusive. If you're a Christian, you can say God has all kinds of reasons for doing certain things. If there are bad things happening, then yes, God values free will and freely performed right actions, and he values our moral and spiritual development, which is why he allows us to go through quite a bit of things, and we're in rebellion against him, so he doesn't have any sort of obligation to make sure that things always go perfectly for us. So it's not that you have to pick one or the other. It's that there are tons of reasons. There are tons of reasons for that have been offered. I'm not saying that these are that any one of them is correct. But there are tons of reasons that have been presented for God to allow certain things. And again, if this is being offered as the atheist's refutation of theism, the question is, how do you as an atheist say, no, that's not good enough, given what atheism teaches about, you know, the origin of your reasoning and moral views?
Well, we are going to take another quick break right here, and when we come back, we're going to be wrapping things up. I'm Nick Peters. My guest is Dr. David Wood, and we're talking about the problem of evil. We'll be back after this break.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show, free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That, again, is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
And we're back. You're talking with Dr. David Wood about the problem of evil. Now, you were talking, when we were talking about the problem of natural evil, about God withdrawing his blessings when we live in rebellion. And some people could say, yeah, but innocent people get caught in the crossfires. And one example I'm thinking is something you'd said earlier today is, for instance, birth defects. I remember growing up and being took to the birth defect center here constantly to figure out what kind of defect I had, and we've concluded it's Asperger's, a form of autism, and as you know, my wife has the exact same condition, and while to me I do see several blessings, there are hindrances to having a birth defect, and I could add in I've got scoliosis as well, and that surgery was certainly not pleasant to go through. So it does seem innocence get caught in a crossfire, and birth defects are a part of it. So if God's going to punish the evil people, why not just punish the evil ones and leave the good ones out of it?
Well, yeah, that would be one criticism of this response. If God is punishing people for their sin, why not proportion it to the sin, right? And so why not, the bigger sinner you are, the worse things go for you, and the nicer and better you are, the better things go for you. But I don't think the Christian view, as far as, you know, people being in rebellion against God, I don't think that it's that the response is that God is punishing individual people. Of course, he can. But as far as generally why God is not here constantly protecting people is not because that individual over there did something wrong and therefore God is punishing those individuals, but you know, that little old lady over there, she's much nicer and she's a Christian, therefore, you know, she doesn't go through anything. From a Christian perspective, it's from the beginning we sinned against God, and as a race of human beings, we have sinned against God, and we all do that. The nice little baby, and the drug dealer, and you know the nice little old lady have all done. You know, we're all in rebellion against God. We've all sinned, and so it's not this or that person is the source of, you know, the hurricane or something like that. I think the general view is that human beings in general are doing wrong things, and that God therefore isn't sort of just protecting our world, right? It's not that God is withholding protection from a particular person or something like that. It's that God isn't upholding and sustaining our entire world the way he could if we weren't in this sort of state we're in.
Mm-hmm. So how does this mesh with something like birth defects, for instance?
Well, the idea here is that if you think about, you know, why a birth defect occurs, two of my sons have a genetic muscle disorder, and it's caused by a mutation in one of the chromosomes, and that it's one little base pair, you know, the base pair is the strands of DNA. One little base pair in an endless series, almost endless series, I mean, as far as what you can imagine, one little base pair, get the wrong letter, and your muscles don't work. And so if you think about that, that's something God could obviously take care of, because the mutation happened generations ago, right? I mean, this could have been going on. This could have been going on for 1,000 years. Basically, half of the male children on my wife's side of the family would die. And the reason is, if you have a daughter, since it's X-linked, the daughters won't get it. They carry. They can be carriers of it, but it doesn't affect them. It's only the sons, because the sons only have one X chromosome, that if they get the bad one, then their muscles don't work. And so your daughters can live fine, normal lives, but half of their sons will have the disorder. So this has been going on for a long time, but it's obviously something that God can prevent, right? So God can make sure that the mutation never happened in the first place, or once the mutation has happened, God can correct it anytime he wants. The idea of if you're taking this route, and again, I'm not even saying this is the correct route to take. This is we're trying to give the, you know, sort of main kinds of different responses that have been offered. If you're a Christian and you're just taking the route, look, human beings are in rebellion against God. God is under no obligation to make things go right for us. The idea here is, since when is God under some kind of obligation of people who have turned against him? Since when is God under some kind of obligation to go in there and say, oh man, there's a mutation about to take place. It's going to, you know, affect future generations, but I need to go in there and fix it and make sure these sorts of things don't go wrong. From a Christian perspective, that claim that God needs to make, let's say, birth go perfectly, it can make sense to individuals, but from the worldview of Christianity, it doesn't make a lot of sense. What I mean by that is, if you go really just a few hundred years ago, if you go a few hundred years back in history, the problem of evil was not very persuasive to people. To most people, even very smart people, even very educated people, the problem didn't even arise. Even if they were discussing theism or its reasons for it or the reasons against it, the problem of evil just wasn't very persuasive to people. And it's no coincidence that the first formulation of the problem of evil that we have comes from Epicurus, who's the father of hedonism, right? That's his field of philosophy. Mm-hmm. He's the inventor of hedonism, yeah. That pleasure is the greatest good and pain is the greatest evil, right? So it's no coincidence that the first formulation of the argument from evil that we have comes from this guy, right? Who's the one who says pleasure is what's good, pain is what's bad. Because once you have that as your chief good, pleasure, then if you're saying a God who is good created the world, then what you're saying is a God whose main goal would be us having pleasure created the world. But we're obviously not having as much pleasure as we could, so this sort of being obviously doesn't exist. That's sort of where it comes from early on. But if you go to you go to the Apostle Paul, or really lots of the people in the Bible, I mean, think about the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul persecutes the church. He becomes a Christian. And then he's one of the most dedicated servants of God who's ever lived. I mean, he goes, he's tortured, he's stoned, he's ultimately beheaded. It just never occurs to the Apostle Paul to say, man, I'm really serving God really hard here. Why are bad things happening to me? Much worse things are happening to me than are happening to these other people who are minding their own business. Why are all the bad things happening to me? I'm serving God harder than everyone else. That never crosses his mind. They didn't associate this, they didn't have this association where if you're serving God, everything's going to go right for you. They had a general idea of, you know, if you're being good, obeying God, things are usually going to go pretty well for you in life, and that God can bless you. They had that, but this idea that God is going to protect us from all these things going wrong, it just doesn't occur to them that this should be a refutation of their views. It's not until you get really down to the past couple centuries that this really starts making sense to people, that if this sort of being exists, he's going to make sure everything goes right for us. He's going to make sure everything goes right during childbirth. He's going to make sure everything turns out well, that there's no hunger, that there's no natural disasters, that these sort of things don't happen. And if you think about the history of human development, well, as time goes on, we're becoming more and more hedonistic in our mentality. In other words, we're agreeing more and more with Epicurus that's what's important in life. In other words, if you take people nowadays and ask them what's most important, well, you know, getting a good house and getting a nice car and getting a lot of money and you know, having enough for retirement and so on. Notice all of those things that are important are things about living nice, comfortable life. Well, if those are the things you regard as most important, then obviously when you think about God, what should God be doing? Well, if he's perfectly good, he should really want me to be as comfortable as possible and want all these things to go right and not want all these things to go wrong for me. In other words, he should have the same sort of values that I have. And so the argument from evil has becomes progressively more persuasive as people develop a more hedonistic attitude. In other words, as pain and pleasure move higher up on your scale of values, the argument becomes more persuasive. But if we sort of divorce ourselves from this view of pain and pleasure, and we stop and we think, what again, you only asked about from the Christian perspective. From a Christian perspective, God has no obligations to us, right? God has no obligations to, God isn't obligated to create me to begin with, let alone to give me 10 minutes of existence, let alone an entire life. God isn't obligated to make me any sort of way. So what sense does it make to say that now, even after we're in a state of rebellion, we sin, we veer away from God, we have these tendencies to veer away, to go our own way, to act out of selfishness, that God has to make, God has to jump in and stop mutations and prevent birth defects and so on. You can say it'd be nice, but I don't see how you can say that this is, because if we're talking about a response internal to Christianity, you'd have to show that this is illogical from a Christian perspective, that from within Christianity, there's some incoherence here, that God, the God we're saying exists, would stop things like that, would block birth defects, would make sure everything goes right. And within Christianity, there's nothing like that.
It does ultimately seem to, and we're going to start wrapping things up here, but it does ultimately seem that the problem usually results that it's about us. It's that we want things to be perfect, and as long as we don't have what we want, there's a problem.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and that's, if you sit down and you think about the sort of world that's being demanded, it would be a hedonistic paradise. That's the sort of world that we want. But if you think about it, it would have to be a world where we don't have free will, because we wouldn't be allowed to rebel against God in that, unless we want a hedonistic paradise where we're all cursing God all day. It would have to be a hedonistic paradise where we have no free will and there's no kind of spiritual moral development, no redemption, no anything. And the question of how an atheist or a naturalist can look at that world and say, it's so clearly better, it's so much clearly better than our world, where we have lots of evil and we have lots of struggles, but we also have a lot of other things as well that wouldn't exist in this hedonistic, free will, free paradise that we're being presented with as the alternative. I don't see how you can say this is so clearly a superior world, this hedonistic paradise. It's so clearly superior that you have to reject theism because you can recognize that this world would be so much better.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got a little over 5 minutes left. So, Dr. Wood, if someone's been listening to this and they really like what they've heard and they'd like to find out more about you and things like that, maybe see any materials you might have on this topic, how can they find you?
Well, but most of the stuff actually in the as far as the problem of evil is concerned, most of the stuff like my dissertation and so on is at a level that's only interesting to philosophers. This is my dissertation is actually on the Bayesian argument from evil, which is a more recent version of the problem of evil. It's being presented by Bayesian philosophers who argue using Bayesian inference, which theory of inference. But it's very technical and just not interesting to non-philosophers. But as far as people about, you know, what I'm putting out for normal human beings who aren't really weird like philosophers, as far as normal human beings, I have a YouTube page. It's just Act 17 Apologetics. That's the channel, and I put up videos there pretty regularly.
Well, I guess I know which category I fall into, because I was getting pretty excited thinking about reading about the problem of evil from a Bayesian perspective.
Oh, yeah. No, you're one of the weirdos when it comes to philosophy and theology and stuff.
Yeah, and I actually take that as a compliment. Okay, we've only got about 4 minutes left also. What are some final words you'd like to say on the problem of evil, and maybe advice for people who find the problem of evil a problem?
Yeah, well, this is something I alluded to earlier, but there is this tendency, and it goes kind of hand in hand with what I said about atheists when they're responding to a theist argument. If you present an argument for the resurrection or a cosmological argument or design argument and so on, if you present one of these arguments, an atheist will look for any premise that he can doubt, even by a stretch of the imagination. And this will be, in cases like the cosmological argument, this will be things like anything that begins to exist must have a cause. There are atheists who will actually deny that. No, something can begin to exist without a cause. So they will doubt what I would regard as some of the most obviously true premises ever. And they will say, you can't prove it to me. Therefore, your argument fails. If that's the standard, then the question is, look, you atheists, you're giving me an argument. You're giving me an argument against theism. What, given your burden of proof, if you haven't proven anything to me, or if I have any reason to doubt any one of your premises, I get to reject the argument, right? In other words, I call this the skeptic's dilemma. If we want to be consistent, then we either have to be very skeptical, very critical of arguments as they come in, whether they're for theism or against theism, or we have to, you know, be less skeptical and, you know, sort of let things slide. In other words, not proving things with 100% certainty, things like that. Well, if there are only two possibilities, right? If we're going to be very skeptical of arguments for theism, then we need to be consistent and have the same level of skepticism towards arguments against theism. So when the atheist offers the argument from evil, then if that same atheist has been very, very skeptical of arguments for theism, well, great, then great. I'm going to demand proof for every little premise that you've offered, and you are going to fail. You're going to fail. That argument is going to fail. In other words, if we apply the same level of skepticism to the argument from evil that we apply to arguments for theism, the argument from evil doesn't get off the ground. It doesn't get anywhere. There are too many places to doubt. There are too many possible theodicies. There are too many problems with the argument. So if we're consistently skeptical, then we have to reject the argument from evil, and there is no argument against the existence of God here. If, on the other hand, the atheist is going to say, even though there are some problems with his argument, it's still a pretty good argument, well, what you've just told me is, I don't need to prove everything with 100% certainty. You can let certain things slide. And if that's the case, then I think almost every major theistic argument is going to pass that test. In other words, theistic arguments are usually based on pretty solid premises. So if you're not going to start being super skeptical here, and you're going to say the argument from evil passes, well, great, then I have way more arguments than you have, and I win by sheer volume. So either way, whether we're very skeptical or whether we're not very skeptical, whether we're critical or not very critical, The argument from evil just doesn't do what it's supposed to do.
Okay. Well, with that, we're going to have to wrap things up. I'd like to thank Dr. David Wood for being my guest. And remember, everyone, we're going to be talking about this next week with Greg Gansar, who David Wood assures us is the man. So, again,
correct.
Thanks, Dr. Wood, and I hope we'll see you back here again sometime.
All right. Catch you later.
Okay. Bye. And we'll see you all next week.